Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Maher. Michelle Maher is the 2012 winner of the Patricia Dobler Poetry Award. Her work has appeared in journals such as the Georgetown Review, Atlanta Review, Chautauqua Literary Journal, and US One Worksheets. She is a professor of English at La Roche College. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Jan, I am well. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to have you on the show. I just realized that it's your first time and should have been years ago, so my apologies for that. But you have a manuscript entitled What Lasts that you're going to be reading from.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. This first poem is entitled Pierced, and it begins with a memory located in Denali National Forest in Alaska. So that's where the poem begins. Pierced. If I left the world and could come back for one thing only, I would choose this. The light coming off the mountains, the wind pressing fireweed and purple lupine against our knees, the shadows of clouds spilling over us as they blow across the mountaintops. Through binoculars, we see the wind riffling the fur of a mother bear as she guides her cubs across the valley. The grass grows without our direction, while silvery braided streams run in the range below. Perhaps this is what was meant when the Lord said he would take away our stony hearts and give us natural hearts. For how can we see the world clearly unless we are pierced? In Vancouver once, I saw a man, late 20s or early 30s, on a street corner in a wheelchair with his right leg missing. Have a good night, have a good night, he said to people walking past, smiling at everyone, whether or not they gave him money. For a moment, I am riven between wishing I were a better person and gratitude simply for being here, in fading light, for these few hours. The next poem, Jan, is a Pittsburgh poem, and it's situated in Kennywood, and I think it's rooted in the idea that I tend to believe whatever someone I love, whatever they tell me. And this is a fatal flaw when it comes to raising teenagers. Good heavens. But this poem is entitled Carousel. Sweaty with sugar and grime in the long line looping around the carousel, my brother told me snakes live in the belly of the wooden merry-go-round horses. And that if I put my hand in the mouth of one as I rode, a snake would dart out between the horse's large yellowing teeth, curling lips, and bite me. 50 years later, I still move gingerly as I ride the carousel and reach forward to place my fingers on my horse's lips, then touch my own. This is another poem dealing with family, and I think for me, one of the greatest challenges in writing poems deals with family secrets or things that I never thought would be worthy or appropriate for poetry. And it turns out that's usually where poetry needs to go. Blazing. 22. I'm tethered like a goat to a stake in the middle of the lot as we go round and round, her words rushing forth almost too fast for me to catch. We circle the parking lot with its patch of beaten-down grass, a warped plastic fish-cleaning table, and a rusty pole hung with a windsock at its center. I walk alongside my mother as she gestures grandly, her hands chopping the humid air. Watching us, his glasses gleaming in strong light, my father sits, his shadow stark against the siding of our cabin. We're too far away for him to hear my mother telling me of her latest affair. I'm sick to feel such joy, such bitterness towards my father. Like a feverish animal, I'm soured on everything. The dusty, flattened grass, the smell of rotting fish, the too hot sun blazing over everything. Another type of poem I enjoy writing is ekphrasis poetry. Ekphrasis poetry simply is poetry that refers to a painting, a sculpture, a photograph. This is entitled At the Brera, Milan. The breath of the chest seems immense, the face strained as if in troubled sleep. The marble stillness of the corpse matches the red-veined marble table on which the body rests. There is no place else to look. We are thrust almost atop the body. Its torn flesh, from which no blood flows, is draped with linen. Foreshortened legs and tiny feet. Look, there is a jar of ointment by the pillowed head. Beyond, an open door leading to a burial room. The body seems beyond decay with its flowing hair, smooth bent arms, and hands loosely curled into cloth as liquid and still as poured stone. At the center of the canvas, the bulging drapery at the loins reminds us this had been a man in his vigor, now stretched on a slab as if poised to catapult into our midst. The world to come has not entered here. A reddish glow covers everything, and even the weeping figures shunted to the side, St. John, the Virgin, Mary Magdalene, aged, ravaged with grief, are incidental to this dead Christ's Montaigne painted for his own funerary chapel, which stands before us as if made for our own, the room of our witness, which we enter and are still.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Maher, and she's reading from her manuscript entitled What Lasts. I was really interested in what you were talking about regarding family secrets and how there's a lot of energy around that material. Can you talk about how you got past fear or resistance writing about those things?
Oh, sure. It's been a long, long journey, and primarily what helped me was reading the work of other poets. Toy Derricotte, Stanley Plumley, Natasha Trethewey. And what the other poets showed me, and being in workshops, what I've learned is that those places that make you uncomfortable are often exactly where you need to go. That's what we have to offer as artists, as poets, because from those experiences come our unique perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the biggest fears I always had was that if I revealed myself, I would simply be too vulnerable, too open to being judged, and that other family members wouldn't approve. So finally, what pushed me past that was the love of the art itself, and faith in the language, faith in the words themselves. When in doubt, that will carry you through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good answer. I think it's so necessary to find that courage, and yet it's not an easy thing. And as you say, going to the work of other writers is a great place. You know, it's interesting in your work because I feel like there's so much at stake in your work. I always feel that, and which I think is a great thing. Mm-hmm. And and I think it shows in your language some of the things you've read just so far. I just have written down some phrases that have so much energy, tethered like a goat to a stake, like a feverish animal, I'm soured on everything. Mm-hmm. You have some just wonderful language that shows the depth of emotion that's going on in these poems. Can you talk about getting to that language? Is that a first choice thing, or has that come with many revisions for you?
I always tell my students that if I could learn how to drive a stick shift, they could learn how to write a poem. And what I mean by that is that there has never been a time when I didn't sit down at my desk or start writing when I didn't think, this is crap, this is awful. And what will happen is that, and this is what I tell my students too, I've learned over time to just kind of acknowledge those voices and move on. Kind of say, yes, thank you, you've had your say. But you have to, for me, it's like moving into a lake that feels kind of cold at the beginning. But you have to get to that point. Jan, I could not have written these poems. I'm 55 now. I could not have written these poems when I was a younger person. I didn't have the strength. I didn't even have the formal knowledge of poetry to even do that. But
what do you mean by strength?
I would not have had the strength to say, this is what I lived through or this is what I experienced, and to own that. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of the artist who I love the most, and I think so much of being a poet, is claiming your voice, mm-hmm. and saying, regardless of how other people may or may not have experienced something, this is what I have lived through. And at the end of the day, that's the only thing we can offer one another. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that.
Okay. Okay. Can you read some more?
Oh, sure. This is entitled Five or Six Therapists Ago. Five or six therapists ago, one of the best I ever had said she could help, but this scared me. We had just met, and she couldn't see the cage inside my chest where black snakes knotted and twisted like those at a strip shopping mall when I was three and it rained hard. So that the fair was canceled and men and women were busy loading animals back into trucks. I stood in a puddle watching the black snakes lie quietly in their wire crate, the rainbow oily water still and fresh. I was afraid, but couldn't move away, until my mother pulled me towards the car. What will you do when your fingertips brush the wire mesh and the snakes pull and glide against each other, a knot of rippling skin? I will help you if I can. The next poem is entitled Sharing Blood, and it's about an experience that my husband and I had years ago when we went to the New Orleans Jazz Festival to see Miles Davis. Sharing Blood. I'd been so exhausted from the cheap motel we'd stayed in, gunshots at night. I slumped, feet on the railing. Drifting in and out of I Waited for You. The first song of his I ever heard, one that made me love his music. Davis never said a word, just played, occasionally pointing to the young musicians in his band to solo. When you work with great musicians, they are always a part of you. People like Max Roach, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Bird, Diz, Dak DeJohnette, Philly Joe. The ones that are dead I miss a lot, especially as I grow older. Monk Mingus, Freddie Webster, and Fat Girl. Years later, I read Davis's autobiography, how he defined his family not as the people who shared his blood, but who understood his music. I got that because I was looking for work, and what I wanted most was a tribe. It's all in me, the things I learned to do from them. Music is about the spirit and the spiritual, and about feeling. I believe their music is still around somewhere, you know. I close my eyes and hear the notes he drew from his horn, deep and clear, like a line stretched taut, slicing down to the deepest part of the ocean, where some creature struggles against being dragged up, while he pulls and pulls against its enormous weight. The next poem, Deep Blue Bowl, comes out of the experience of my mother dying in the fall of 2013. Deep Blue Bowl. I think of how I saw my mother again today as I left school. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw her head in profile up above the roof of the college against a sky of azure blue, tiny white wings at her neck like a fluffy collar. She looked so happy, laughing with others whose faces I couldn't see, her face young and radiant, as if she were in a group of high school friends at a dance or football game. And I'm surprised whenever I see her. And I've seen her a few times since she died in November. How happy she is without me. Really? I want to say. You left me with boxes of photos and no one to call who will be interested in my day down to its tiniest detail. I want to be somebody's child again, consoled and loved. As you grow younger, I grow older. Under this sky, a deep blue bowl. The next poem is To Return is to Carry. What would it mean to see with the eyes of a woman recently returned from the dead? What if her vision were funneled down to a narrow prism, a shaft of raw crystal edged in flame that sears away everything inconsequential? If a man were to walk past carrying wood, he would ignore her, a poor woman in a stained robe. She has no message to give, no alarm to raise. What could she tell him? Only what she never expected since she awakened, staring at a gray sky. To return is to carry a thirst so deep it seems like grief. Soon she must find a village, but for now rests in front of a bare tree, head in hands. What lasts? What lasts?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Maher, reading from her manuscript, What Lasts. Was that the title poem that you just read?
That's the title poem of the book, yes, because what I found out that I seem to be most interested in writing about is what lasts in a perishing world, in a world where everything is mortal. What survives? What keeps going?
Yeah, I mean, I was writing things down like life and death, the survival, and, you know, one thing I love about your poems is there's a really clear voice that is consistent throughout, you know, no matter what the poems are saying, and I think that's a great strength. There's a sense of the dramatic in your work. I mean, not overly dramatic, but just there's big things happening, and like you just said, things that perish. I mean, perish is a heavy word, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems that you go right to it. You go right to it, which I think is great. Has that always been, you know, what drives you as a poet?
Yes. And I think also being a middle-aged person, a middle-aged woman, but I think death is the litmus test or the measuring stick. And I'm as scared of dying as anyone, but I also think that it's a great blessing because I think if poetry tells us nothing else, it tells us to be here now, to be in the present moment. And even if our lives are painful, and everybody's life is sooner or later at different times, that not to miss a single moment, to try to be aware and alive to that moment.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to argue with that.
Dear heavens.
No, it just took me back to the 60s, you know, that book, Be Here Now.
Really?
Yeah. It was a very cosmic book.
Oh, Lord.
Okay.
Oh, heavens. Okay. And it sounds like when I hear that title of a book, I think of, I remember my parents having I'm Okay, You're Okay. And I just thought, oh, wow.
Well, this was a lot cooler than that.
That wasn't the way I was raised. You know,
In other words,
if we didn't do what we were told, we were not okay.
That's right.
So anyhow.
Yeah. Well, that was a book.
Right. Okay. That wasn't real life. Got it.
Well, I have to say that I was frightened by the one poem. The snake poem really scares me. I mean, that's the second time you're talking about snakes today.
Oh, my.
The black snakes in the rainbow oily water. That freaked me out. But, yeah, I mean, first the snakes are coming out of the carousel horse's mouth, and then this one, they're in this oily water.
Yeah, I never really noticed that, but you're absolutely right.
And I mean, I think it's great that you can frighten someone with a poem, but are there more snakes in your book?
You know what? Now that I don't think so. I'm trying to think of this. I don't think so, but I think that there are snakes in the sense that a lot of the poems are based on either awkward moments or moments that are unexpected and where things just seem to open up.
Childhood moments.
Right.
Fear, too.
Yeah.
Okay, can you read some more poems?
Oh, sure. Let me think here. Just so we don't think that it's all about, snakes, or we're going to run off and put our heads in the oven after this. This is entitled Driveway, Late September. Walking along the driveway to get the paper before work, hair blows into my mouth, twigs skitter across the pavement. I reach down, and all at once it feels as if I've eaten an enormous box of dark chocolates or stepped into the vault of heaven. An enormity of joy buoys me off the cement, and out of the corner of my eye, I see milky blue air stretching around my body like melting glass. Three translucent steps appear right in front of me. I walk up, six or seven selves trailing behind. Standing level with the roofs of cars, the breeze blows on my bare legs for a breath, maybe two, then I'm back on the driveway. Trees shuffle bars of light, concrete glints with wet yellow leaves, heaps and heaps of molten gold everywhere. This is entitled Eastern Redbud. At the Mother House grounds, Sisters of Divine Providence, the tangled crown of branches shivers with an electric hum that causes my skin to itch as carpenter bees fly and crawl over purple blossoms. This eastern redbud quivers with their industry as I lean carefully back against the trunk, squinting upwards. My day's work is almost done. If Julian of Norwich were here to see the zigzag of twigs swollen with buds of deep rose and purple, she would have approved. She who had a vision of Christ's head encircled with thorns, the blood running down his face like pellets of water pouring down eaves of a house, the drops as round as the scales on a herring. She saw the divine pressing against the mortal world like debris of leaves pressed onto the grates of storm drains after heavy rain. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. I pull up my knees to my chin and look down a slope so green I blink. A brace of ducks skim across a pond. The young go right in, heedless of the cold. Flesh. I would rip wings off bumblebees and cry surprised when stung. Baking soda poultices clotted my fingertips, but I ran outside and kept at it until I felt my hands hurt more than the pleasure I had in destroying what was helpless within my grasp. Now, barefoot, I avoid clover and pull down my shirt sleeves when I go outside. The closest I get to bees is watching them swarm the lilac outside my closed kitchen window. At 10, I ran in a fireball of games, baseball diamond to swimming pool, heedless of what I hated. A girl down the street, a neighbor's dog. A cruelty possessed me I wish would tear into my flesh again, spring up like a wound fresh torn and flowing, yielding a heartlessness which says, tomorrow, you are ready for tomorrow, just by being alive.
You know, I think it's also this juxtaposition of poems that have Julian of Norwich in them and then the really scary poems. And, you know, it's the range that you have that brings a lot of power to the manuscript. I mean, even though in the poem may be talking about blood drop, you know, the blood of Christ, but you choose to describe it as blood drops round as scales of a herring, which to me is very frightening.
Well, you know what? I cannot claim credit for that. Okay. That comes from Julian of Norwich,
oh, okay.
That kind of thing. So she
well,
got
she's
there.
Scaring me then.
Well, I hear you. But she is a good, I don't know, 400 or 500 years before this time. So yeah, she got there first. Much better poet than I. Well, absolutely. No. There you go.
But and you're choosing to reproduce that line. All I'm saying is, you know, it's an interesting juxtaposition of things in your work.
Well, I think that's partly the hazard of being an English teacher, where the literary stuff just crops up willy-nilly.
Okay, but you're not owning that. You have some really intense stuff in your work. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
Well, that, I think, is what attracts me to poetry and to the work of other poets.
Okay.
That's what I look for.
Okay. We have time for another poem.
Okay. This poem is entitled Cooler Hours, and I think it reflects the blessings of growing older, Jan.
This better be a good poem.
Well, you know what it is. When I see my students, when I see my daughters, they're young, they're beautiful, but I would not go back for love nor money to being in my teens, 20s, or even early 30s. Good heavens. I just remember the struggle to find work, you know, to do whatever, to establish a life. Anyhow, this is entitled Cooler Hours. I wander out to the balloon flowers, blue and swollen, opening into a haze of focused, determined bees. Once I thought that by my 50s, I would know what I was doing, or at least enough to credibly fake it, so comfortable in my skin that I would dissolve into the motions of each hour. Slowly, I water the blooms in the heat of late afternoon, when most of the water burns off, but some remains, sustaining them until cooler hours. And far be it from me, Jan, to end poetry without a poem related to death.
Okay.
So here we are, mortality always with us, and this is entitled Death Gives Us. Death gives us what nothing else can, a woman as solid as a boulder, squatting in the middle of the road, a triangular monolith. Yes, her we can rest on. She is strong enough to carry us when nothing else can. She gathers us. Can she take our love? I think so. That darkness takes what we carry. She comes down on the side of us that lives in the world we suffer in, but asks for more. Our rock, our womb, our strength. When we fail, she will carry us, her hair long, covering her face, her hands full of stars.
The poetry of Michelle Maher. She's reading from her manuscript, What Lasts. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Jan, thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.